Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Joyce Lieberman is joining us. She's the radio engineering supervisor at WHYY in Philadelphia. You may have heard her name associated with Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR. Chris Tarr is with us too, so join us for Joyce Lieberman coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store with outstanding service, savings, and support online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio. Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com.
By Nautel, worry-free transmission you can count on with outstanding control, reliability, efficiencies, and Nautel's unmatched 24/7 customer support online at Nautel.com.
And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb at the top of the tower. A lot more microphone today. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Appreciate Telos Alliance giving me a little time off on Thursdays to talk with industry greats, terrific engineers, people associated with the industry, people to talk about technicalities and things like that. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful winter day here in Nashville, approaching spring, and I can't wait. But enough about me. Let's check into Mequonago, Wisconsin, because Chris Tarr is here. Yay, Chris Tarr. Hey, man, how you doing?
Hey, good. I it's been sad. I kind of miss you guys. I've been working. It's the good and the bad side about the nice weather we've been having is that, you know, it's not snow, but that also means I've got a lot of stuff going on in the field. So even today, you know, got home after three here, so I was, you know, cruising to make sure I was here on time to join us. So yeah, it's been great here. Overcast today. We've just had some amazing weather. We got up to almost 70 the other day, which is unheard of in, you know, the end of February. So we're kind of wondering if we're going to get any more, you know, significant snow this year, because so far, you know, temperatures have been in the 50s. I mean, I'm not complaining. I'm good with it.
Well, here in Nashville, we don't plant nothing until after tax day. That's for sure. Because we've had freezes as late as, I think, April 17th or so. So a lot of folks wait until May the 1st. But enough about planting seeds. I want to bring in our guest because I can't wait to talk to her. It is Joyce Lieberman, who is the radio engineering director, supervisor at WHYY. Hello, Joyce. Welcome in. Good to see you.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thanks for asking me to come on. Yeah.
Chris and I cannot wait to chat with you. And Joyce, I believe that I became aware of you, of your job some years ago, but it was at some industry function where Skip Peasy singled you out, mentioned you, talked about you for a minute, and I thought, I got to meet her. And then a few years ago, Joyce, we sat down at a table and chatted about audio over IP and got to know each other a little bit better then. But I've always known you as the person who works engineers WHYY and associated you with Fresh Air. Do I have that pretty well right?
Well, for years I've been associated with Fresh Air, so you have that right. Currently, there's a different technical director of Fresh Air. It's Audrey Bentham. But I was there at the beginning when Terry was first hired. She was hired in 1975, and Terry did a three-hour local show for Philadelphia. And then it wasn't until 1987 that the show went national. And I had been working with her since probably 1977, mostly on each daily show. She'd interview people that were in town from the Mike Douglas Show, which was a show that was on years and years ago on one of the networks. So people would come across town and be on Terry's show. And she'd also do, of course, authors and lots of people that were in Philadelphia, different thinkers, educators, and lots of interesting people. Occasionally, she'd get to play a tape back from another radio station, and these tapes were sent, and it was said that they were bicycled across the country. They actually weren't sent on a bicycle, but they were mailed from the United States Postal Service. But Terry would play some of those modules back, some of those tapes back. And then I worked with her for years. I came to WHYY as a volunteer. I was working on a show called, the show was called Learning to Fly, and the group was called Radio Free Women. And then in 1976, I was hired on a Corporation for Public Broadcasting grant because there were so few women in television and radio at the time. And I was trained all over the station in television and radio, and I settled in radio. And then coming back to Fresh Air, Fresh Air went national on May 11th, 1987, and we did a live show with Peggy King in the studio doing a live concert, and it was Irving Berlin's birthday, so she sang Irving Berlin songs. And then since that time, we've been doing the Fresh Air show, and I did the main driving of the show for about 9 years until I became a radio engineering supervisor. So as a radio engineering supervisor, I got more involved with maintenance and troubleshooting and installing systems, selecting systems to put in, and it was all over the station, not just for Fresh Air.
We have got a lot to talk to you about, Joyce, and Chris will be chatting with you as well, because Chris has some experience in non-commercial broadcasting. And actually, I got my start in public radio at WEKU-FM. I was, I ran the board and a variety of shows, and then ended up doing a little bit of announcing and news. Hey, we always have a quick mention of one of our sponsors early in the show, and that is Nautel at Nautel.com. We got a quick video clip here from a transmission Talk Tuesday. Let's hear about it.
Steve Schoen has asked, is it okay to use an LM34 to monitor outdoor temperature? And if so, how do you protect it from the elements? Josh, have you dealt with that?
Yeah, there are certain board designs. I think CircuitWorks made one that had an LM34 and a few other devices on it. Typically, when we've had to do those outside, we would try to do them in some sort of like a plastic project box or something along those lines, just to make sure that it was sealed up. You know, you have to put it in, but then you got to seal it up real tight with silicone or some kind of a sealing grommet or something like that. And don't use a black box. I had a station that did that. They rolled their own temperature sensor and stuck it outside in a black box, and, you know, 75 degree day, and it was reading 110. Oh, it's so hot. I'm like, it's not. Change it. Typically, the other thing that we recommend is on the bottom, drill some holes. If you mount it on a wall, make sure you drill some holes in the bottom, because you'll have condensation in there and eventually it will fill it up. Not to mention the humidity of the condensation evaporating inside the box is going to corrode your components. So drill a couple of weep holes in the bottom.
Sort of a sidetrack. I walked into a site in Florida once, outside of Largo, near Orlando, and they were off the air and were troubleshooting, and the AC, they kept tripping the breaker. And I mean, it's, what's going on? So walk outside. There's a NEMA box on the outside, one of our surge protectors, which are not really meant to be installed outside. I opened the door, and it let about 4 inches of water out of the box.
There's your problem.
Oops. So yeah.
That's a clip from a Transmission Talk Tuesday discussion. And the next one coming up is May. Is it May? No, it's March. March. It's this month. It's coming up March the 12th. You can register for it right now. The topic will be the rise of contract engineering groups. Go to nautel.com/webinars and click on Transmission Talk Tuesday. And you can register right there. You'll be reminded about it. And it's going to be a good show coming up March the 12th. That's just a few days from right now. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack, Chris Tarr, and our guest is Joyce Lieberman. And Joyce was just kind of starting to fill us in on her career. And Joyce, we're going to talk more about the career and progression and your ideas on how to get yourself known, because you certainly did that. I got a burning question, because I certainly didn't listen. I wasn't a regular listener to the Fresh Air show with Terry Gross, but I always noticed that the audio quality to me always sounded very intimate, I would call it, intimate. And I always felt like Terry was sitting right next to me, talking to me. Can you tell us a little bit about how you made that happen, why the show sounded so personalized?
I think it has a lot to do with the way Terry asks questions and brings the guest in to her mm-hmm. sphere, and Terry is listening to the guest and also responding to questions. For audio, we've used a good quality microphone. For years, we used an RE20, and we would have the mic fairly close to Terry's mouth. Of course, it's audio, so you don't have to worry about, you know, a visual of it. Right now, I'm using more of a shotgun mic. I'm holding it because I didn't have a chance to put it on a mic stand. But with Terry, you know, the mic would be pretty close to her mouth, so the miking was close. We made sure that Terry wasn't popping, that there were no extra mouth sounds or anything like that. The studio has been high quality studio with absorptive material and some reflective material, and we make sure that there's no reflections going back and forth and, you know, making the sound a little strange. Terry wears headphones, closed ear headphones, and that's so that she could really monitor the guest and hear if there's any extraneous sounds, or if occasionally sometimes the way things are set up with the mix minus and just making sure that we're getting the guest's audio pure and Terry's audio pure also, just to make sure that there's no extra echo sounds or anything like that happening. And now we use a Neumann mic for Terry. It's a TLM microphone, and that's richer. It plays to the, you know, mid-range of her voice better, I think, than the RE20 did.
Yeah. It's interesting how, and Chris, I'd like you to chime in too about this. Whenever I would tune in to Fresh Air, my brain always knew what to expect in terms of the sound of Terry. And I realize that part of it, that is her voice. She has a terrific voice for radio. It's very engaging and very, very personal and intimate, I would say. It sounds like she's just right there next to me talking to me. But I knew the mic technique and the room, that all has to play into it. Chris, you've worked in some community radio, and I know you've put together interviews with people and you wanted them to sound, you know, right there with the microphone. What's been your thoughts on what Joyce said and your own technique?
Well, you know, Radio Milwaukee, when I built that facility, that was I think a $4 million build. You know, the theory behind this, or the thought behind this, is it is the audio. I mean, that's what we do. We don't have advertisers. We have supporters. We have, you know, programming that is specific to specific audiences and those sorts of things. You know, we were just talking earlier about David Dye and World Cafe. You know, he did the show a couple times from our facility. So, you know, we don't all, you know, people are donating their money for what they're getting back out from the speakers, basically. So when I design the studios and design the audio chains, it is all about quality. You know, it's all about the, you know, the nuances in the audio. You know, you the way you do the audio processing, the microphones you use, and even what she was talking about earlier here with sound techniques in the rooms. You know, the way we, acoustically treated things. We had our second floor of the building. This was we built it in an old machine shop, and the second floor of our building, we had a green room where a lot of times there'd be performances or you know, that sort of thing, but the roof, the ceiling was the original steel roof. So we actually, you know, spray treated that and, you know, called it the cone of silence because it worked so well. We had, you know, these things we could wheel out. One side was reflective, one side was absorptive, and we could tune a room to make it fit. So, I mean, really, you know, we owed it to not only to our supporters and our listeners, but also to the artists that came in. I mean, we did, you know, we were all about music. I mean, that was our focus. And we would have musicians come in on tour. You know, they'd come in and hang out with us. They'd perform. We had our performance space. So it was out of respect for the artists, respect for the music, and respect for the listeners. So unlike commercial radio, where loud is best and we're in the money to sell advertising, this was very much the quality of the of what came out of the speakers was basically that was it. That was priority number one.
Joyce, you mentioned remote guests. What were some of the equipment and techniques that you used to bring remote guests in?
Well, for the national show, most of the guests were not in the studio with Terry. They're in studios across the country. National Public Radio has a studio in Washington where they have guests to be able to sit down and do the radio show with Terry and other radio shows. There's a New York Bureau of National Public Radio, and there's also a Los Angeles Bureau. So many guests are in those studios. So they outfit them according to the standards of NPR, and NPR has, you know, has often used Neumann microphones. They have good acoustics in their studios. The engineer is on the other side of the glass, so they're listening on speakers or headphones just to make sure that the guest is sounding fine, and Terry is too for the guest. And then we have placed guests in other studios. Could be a recording studio, could be another radio station, a member radio station across the country, maybe in Chicago or some other cities or towns. And then we ask people to use high quality microphones, mic somebody fairly close, and of course make sure there's no popping and mouth sounds. And we request that people use closed ear headphones so that they could hear Terry well and there's no sound leaking out. So you're not going to hear Terry asking them the question over their microphone. You just hear the answer.
You know, I never thought of that as a requirement for when you, you know, when you have somebody on remote, there's going to be a little bit of delay. And I guess you want to keep any evidence of that delay out of the finished product, don't you?
Sure, definitely. And there are times when a little bit is getting in and then we we'll message the engineer that maybe the guest's headphone volume is up too high so that they could bring it down, but of course the guest still has to hear what's going on. So it's a fine balance. When Terry was doing the local show, most of the guests were in the studio. There wasn't the funding for renting studios and even paying National Public Radio for the rental of the studios. So most of the guests, practically all the guests, were live in the studio. There was one time Bobby Steele was live in the studio, and he was in Philadelphia, so he came over and was able to talk to Terry. There were actors and actresses that were coming through town. Again, they were probably on the Mike Douglas show, which was across town. A commercial television station had lots of guests. And then Terry would book special musicians. Terry has a great history for loving jazz, and there would be lots of jazz musicians who are in Philadelphia or who are coming through town who were playing at different clubs in Philadelphia, and of course rock musicians and country and lots of different genres of music as well.
Chris, I think you were about to say something before I jumped in.
No, you're good.
Oh no, okay. Okay.
But I can add to that because we did, you know, again, like I said, we've not only had David die in, but we also sent performances to him to go out on the air. But then, you know, we would do live performances from all over the city. And, you know, early on it was all about ISDN, and we were fortunate that the licensee of the station was the Milwaukee School District. So they had a whole group of people that did nothing but telecom. So, you know, it was pretty easy to get those things set up to wherever we were going to be to do performances. But, you know, I have a very strong memory, just some of the things that we do. We had a group in town, and they did a show for us at one of the local theaters, the music theaters. And they got done with that, and then we needed to send them. They wanted to do an interview for David Dye, with David Dye, that they're going to record. So we set up the ISDN and everything, and they were all wearing headphones. And they were performing, but we had no amplification because we didn't want everything bleeding back into the microphones and everything. So I just remember sitting there watching basically what was, an air guitar performance, you know, as they're beating around. And then, they'd get done and they'd, you'd hear them, talk to David. I couldn't hear what they were saying or what he was saying. I could just, all of a sudden they'd start talking and laughing and things like that. So That was surprising to me how big in at least in our, how we did radio, how important live things were out of studio live things. That's where it got crazy. And that's where, like with mic processing, where that's really important because you need your audio to, you need your audio to cut through, but you don't want it to sound unnatural. The whole thing is to sound natural. And so that was always a big balance, especially for me, because I came from the commercial side and, my inclination was to turn everything up to 11, and you don't do that. That's really wrong. That's the wrong way to do it. So I had to learn too about that, but that, there really is, it's a whole, you want to be able to turn, you can't have fatigue. You can't have processing fatigue. You can't have all these other things that are just kind of expected in commercial radio. Everything needs to be open and clean and clear and in all kinds of environments. You're not always going to be in the studio. You're going to be at, where we're at a music venue or something else. And so we, I had a whole rack of gear of processors and EQs and everything else that I'd run everything through before it went into the ISDN line, just so that I could get it as pristine as possible before it went out and over the air.
We're talking with Joyce Lieberman. She's our guest. Chris Tarr is along as well. We've been talking about the engineering the Fresh Air show on public radio with Terry Gross, and I'm sure a lot of you have listened to that in the past. I used to quite a bit. And I'd like some more answers from Joyce in just a couple minutes about the technicalities, because she was responsible for a lot of the audio there on that show. But right now, we're going to take a quick break for a couple of our sponsors. One of them is Angry Audio, and Chris Tarr knows all about Angry Audio. And Chris, I wonder if you might mind giving us a little bit of information about the mic processing and this interesting philosophy that Angry Audio has toward mic processing. It ain't a generic mic processor. You got to buy the right one.
It was very interesting. I was talking to Mike Dosh about this, and he was talking with Corny Gould about mic processing. And one of the things that came up was, Mike said, I would like to maybe develop a mic processor. But the problem with mic processors is they're so hard to adjust. And Corny said, you got to have all these knobs and everything because each mic is different. And that's where Michael Dosh said, what if we knew what kind of microphone was going to connect to it? And Corny said that, and again, I'm repeating the story from Catfish. Corny said, well, that changes everything because I can set up the processing to tailored to the microphone. And then we don't need all of these settings. We'll need a few settings, but we won't need all of these different gadgets and things because we already know the characteristics of the microphone. We don't need to know, we don't care about frequency response and things like that, because we're going to know what that is. So out from that came the Rebel, the Smooth and the Rebel, and where they got their names. The Rebel RE is for RE20. The Smooth SM is for the SM7. And as you can see from the picture, it's a very simple box. Not a lot of controls on it. There's a few on the inside behind the cover, but very few controls. There's you can adjust the density, you can tweak a few things, brightness, that sort of thing. But there are some interesting features like this. They talk about the room activity, and that's not a gate. Some people think that's just a simple noise gate. It really isn't. You can actually, it sounds like you can adjust the size of the room with reverberation and things like that. So it's got some really neat tricks under its sleeve in the box there. And of course it's Angry Audio. So all of the things like the mic preamps, the audio, everything is put together, very clean, very well done. It's got, built-in power supply. You can kind of see down there, there's some of the controls that you've got. And, they're just very basic. You've got de-essing, you've got drive control for density. And, really that's about it. Filter, the sparkle, just a little, you can tailor it just a little bit. There's no, the EQ where you've got to adjust the frequency and all that stuff. None of that, because we know what sounds best on that microphone because you know the frequency response. So there you go. These things are fantastic. I've heard them in action. They sound great. They're going to make you sound really good. And they're also very natural sounding. So you're not only going to sound good, but you're not going to sound overly processed. And it's hard to, unlike like a 528 or something, it's really hard to make these sound bad. So check it out. Angry Audio. It's the Rebel and the Smooth. They're from angryaudio.com. You can also call your favorite broadcast equipment distributor and ask them for that as well. When these problems come up, don't fear, just get angry. AngryAudio.com.
Don't get mad, get angry. All right, thanks a lot, and thanks to Angry Audio for sponsoring the show. Also, we're brought to you by Max Connect. We started out with Max Connect Wireless years ago. Josh Bone offering a great product, and Josh wants you to know that Max Connect now has a network of contract engineers, and they do special projects as well. They're doing a big project in Indianapolis right now, and they'll do projects all across the country. They also have tower work available, tower workers available to take care of your tower work. Let's take a quick look at this page. What we do, this is from the maxconnect.com website. And if Suncast will scroll down that just a little bit, you can see some of the studios that they build at Max Connect. They handle, easiest for them to handle the southeast and the eastern half of the country, but they'll go anywhere if you need to. They will design and build you studios. They will rebuild your studios for you. If you need work at your transmitter site, they're really good at this too. They can, if you need a new remote control system, you need to automate a lot of things. That's some of the things that Max Connect will do for you. It's the Max Connect Group. I'm so used to saying Max Connect Wireless, but you can see the quality of the work they do, the beautiful wiring, and a lot of this is they can do SNMP. They can also repair a lot of items for you as well. And if they can't repair it, they'll refer you to somebody who does. So Max Connect Group, really, Josh Bone has put together an amazing group of engineers and good salespeople too, who can help you choose the right equipment. They represent a bunch of lines, and we really appreciate Josh. It's great to see his business flourishing, and it's flourishing because people like you, broadcasters, broadcast engineers, recognize when, hey, I don't have time to do this job, or I don't have time to do this job right. Let's get this job done well, guaranteed, and taken care of. And Max Connect Group can do that for you. MaxConnect, MaxConnect.com. We'll have a link in the show notes if you want to check them out further. They build some beautiful studios and do some great transmitter sites. All right. It's Kirk and Chris along with Joyce Lieberman, and we're on This Week in Radio Tech. Joyce, let's see. We talked about fresh air and microphones, and we talked about microphones. We didn't talk about mic processing, and I want to get your take on, Chris mentioned that for one of our sponsors. I guess the best mic processing, things are under control, but you don't really hear it working. What's your philosophy on this topic?
Yes, we try not to use much processing on the Fresh Air show. We have a a limiter set just in case the audio is getting too loud. So we don't want to be clipping when we're sending the show out to National Public Radio to be distributed on the satellite. So we just keep it pretty clean, pretty clear without much processing at all, because at different stations, they probably will be processing. But because it's public radio, there's less processing than would be happening at commercial stations. So I think all the stations have it pretty clear and pristine. And Chris, that must be really challenging to take a live radio show out to a remote site and get the good audio that sounds like you were able to get.
Well, you know, not always. That's the trick, is you're really at the mercy of other people. But it's that same thing that you do in house, where you just have to plan and you have to execute that plan. And so we spent a lot of time in advance looking at the venue, figuring out where we're going to sit, acoustically testing where the best places are. So yeah, it was a challenge, but I think that, it's funny because it's a whole lot harder to do good audio than it is bad. So, it took some time to get everything set up, but it's the same thing we would do in the, in the studio when we had a guests in and you want to make sure, we had and I'm sure you run into this too. One of the hardest parts about this job is we have to be out of the way, and what we do has to kind of be transparent. So for example, they wanted to have a little stage in the studio for their performances. So my job is not to say, well, that's crazy, we're not going to do that. My job is to figure out how to make it work. So, I think that's where some of that comes from too, where, again, our job is to enable these talented people to do whatever they need to do and have the technology stay out of the way. So, there were some times, but it really was neat to kind of be in that space where you are in terms of, really paying attention and having the support too, because in commercial radio, you don't get that support to clean up your audio and make it, really work, because you're using that audio for storytelling. It was really nice to have that support to do that.
Right now might be a good time to bring up the topic. We're going to ask Joyce in a few minutes about her start in the business and some of the things that she did to get noticed. But before we get to that, Chris was just talking about audio. Chris, you kind of mentioned audio improvement or maybe even restoration. And I'd like to jump in this topic. Joyce, you gave a talk at an AES convention just last fall, as a matter of fact, about a big project you've been involved with. And I'd love to hear about that. Tell us what this had to do in the Library of Congress and doing restoration of audio.
Sure. Fresh Air has always recorded their programs. We've been recording each interview on reel-to-reel tape when Terry began work in 1975. All the recordings were on reel-to-reel tape, which we migrated to DAT at some point and CDs. And of course, now we record files from a digital audio workstation on a computer, so we record .wav files. But years ago, after Terry had started the national show, we knew that we wanted to have a Fresh Air archive. So in 2006, we began digitizing tape. So the beginning of it was testing out, which specs to use. We tested higher specs and middle specs. We ended up accepting 44.1 and 16-bit resolution, 44.1 sampling rate, 16-bit resolution. We wanted to record everything at a higher rate, but the cost of servers at the time was a lot, and we just couldn't imagine digitizing all the tapes and having enough money to do everything. So at the beginning, we tested lots of different ways of doing it. We ended up buying a certain digital audio workstation. But even going back to making this archive happen, the archiving started when Danny Miller, the executive producer of Fresh Air, was an intern in 1978 when Terry was doing the local show. And he saw lots of reel-to-reel tapes, some in boxes, some not in boxes, piled up on Terry's desk, on shelves, and said, we have to organize this. So Danny Miller started organizing that. And to make an archive, you need to be very organized. Everything needs to be labeled. There needs to be dates. There needs to be the guest names. There needs to be, you know, a sheet. What Danny ended up coming up with was a fairly simple sheet that he put into each box saying how long the interview was, when we had a contributor on the national show, the name of the contributor, what they were talking about. So it begins with being organized. Then over the years, we got more and more funds to do more of the archiving. So we started digitizing tapes. We started digitizing everything that Terry had done from 1987 when the show first went national. And we did that for about 2 years. And then NPR was interested in digitizing the tapes too. So we formed a partnership with National Public Radio to digitize all of Terry's interviews from 1987. And then at the station locally, we went back to many of Terry's interviews that she had recorded locally, because there was so much good tape stock there. So that brings me to putting together this talk. I put together a PowerPoint to explain the archiving process. It started when I had decided to go to an Audio Engineering Society conference on audio archiving, preservation, and restoration. And that was happening at the Library of Congress in June of 2023. It was just about a year ago. Well, we have a couple of months till June happens. Right after I applied to go, I said, maybe I should present something about the Fresh Air Archive, since I knew lots of the details of it. So I emailed the chairman of the committee. It was John Krivet, and he calls me right back and says, yes, you should do that. You know, of course, we'll have to put it past the scholars. He had a committee of people that would accept and decide which sessions to have at the Library of Congress meeting on archiving, preservation, and restoration. And after about a month, what I proposed was accepted. So then I worked furiously for the next bunch of months from the end of December till June to gather all the information about archiving, preservation. A lot of archiving has to do with having the archive be searchable. So we hired this wonderful librarian who put metadata into the archive and figured out a way to do it and how to search for keywords, key names, so that all the archive that we put together is accessible to the public and people can find things easily. So that's some of it.
Wow. The whole topic of archiving sorry for some simplest questions. Is that always done in real time? It's not faster than real time, is it?
To roll off the reel-to-reel tapes into a wave file, it's real time.
Sure.
And then you have to really be careful with the tape stock. There were some years, late 1970s through the 80s, where a couple of the manufacturers thought that they were providing the correct tape stock, but the adhesive would deteriorate. It was the adhesive that adhered the oxide, where the sound is, to the mylar that is the tape, that would deteriorate somewhat. So when we started archiving, we knew this aspect of it. We knew that we'd have to test out some tapes, put them on a reel-to-reel machine, and just go a little bit, you know, maybe even 30 seconds or a minute for the tape to go. And then soon you could hear the squeakiness across the capstan and the pinch roller and the other mechanisms that are on the transport, and you have to stop and you roll it back up. Then you have to bake the tape at a constant temperature of 125 degrees for at least 8 hours. So for that process, we bought an industrial grade incubator. You could do it with a convection oven, and you could keep the temperature at that rate, but we knew that we had many, many tapes to bake. So it made sense to buy a higher quality piece of equipment. We still have it today, and occasionally we'll go back in and rebake a tape. Once you bake a tape, it's only good for about a month. If you need to do it again, if you need to use, if somehow you don't have the WAV file that you thought you had, we might have to do it again. And it's also encouraged to keep all of the reel-to-reel tape stock. So we have a mezzanine area in our engineering machine room upstairs where all the tapes that Terry has ever recorded are sitting there. I love going through those shelves and just looking at the names of people who Terry's interviewed. It's really a great learning experience to see all those people.
In the process of dubbing from a tape machine into a digital audio workstation, do you ever have problems with the digital audio workstation? I mean, you have to go back and check the file. At least you get a visual indication that things are going okay. But what are some typical snafus that happen on that end of things, if any?
Right. I think for the process that we did, there were less snafus that way. But one person would be listening to one tape going into the a computer workstation so that we can make the WAV files. And then we were able to shortcut it a little bit so that one person can be monitoring two tapes and keep listening back. And then that the person that was doing that task would have to go and spot check the WAV file also. And we came up with a way to do it. Maybe there would be eight or 10 places to spot check. Yeah. Occasionally something wasn't recorded quite right. Either the level wasn't right or something happened. I'm not even sure what exactly happened, but there were times when that person doing that would have to do it again.
So one more question on this topic of archiving things. You mentioned keywords, and you're going to type into a file some keywords about what's being said. But are any of these ever run through a speech-to-text system where you could just get a transcript of the whole thing? Maybe not entirely accurate. Like right now, this very show we're doing right now is being transcribed live, I believe, on Facebook. I've seen it there. Suncast, our producer, would know more. But the technology for that is pretty amazing these days. Does any of that get done?
That's a really good question. And we didn't do that at WHYY, but NPR does that. And NPR has an amazing informational science department. The acronym is RAD, and research, I can't think of what the RAD stands for, but it's more than IT, and it's more than just library science. It's a combination of many different skills and aspects that they're trying to do at NPR. There's this wonderful woman who heads the department, Laura Sotobara, and she and that department, they use Artemis, which is an application that does transfer from audio to a transcript, to a written text. And the NPR does that for All Things Considered and Morning Edition and many other shows and for Fresh Air. So we're lucky to be part of that effort, because when When you look at the freshairarchive.org, which is our WHYY's archived website for Fresh Air, and if you look at National Public Radio, and you could go to the Fresh Air program that's archived there as well, the transcripts are available. So WHYY, Fresh Air, has been able to take advantage of those transcripts. And that's really helpful for people to not only hear the words, but to read the transcript. It's just invaluable to have that. And Artemis is a proprietary software that different people can tailor for themselves. And then it's interesting that NPR puts that together, and then people subscribe to NPR, you know, LexisNexis, different legal groups, different entities to use those transcripts, more especially for the news, for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. But then they have the great advantage of being able to have Fresh Air's interviews also, which I think adds to their base, you know. So that's really wonderful to have that.
We're talking to Joyce Lieberman. She is the radio engineering supervisor at WHYY in Philadelphia. Chris Tarr is along too. Chris, does it worry you at all that everything we say is getting transcribed and maybe stored somewhere?
Heck no. I mean, other than your dad jokes.
Well, those aren't in the final editions, but they are in the live edition. Right. Yeah. Hey, we're going to be back with Joyce and Chris, and Joyce are both going to share with us, but Joyce especially, but Chris has got a couple things too about getting noticed in the business and getting noticed to you know, get the job that maybe you want to do. And Joyce, you know, had, I think, some of the typical difficulties that a female might have in the early days, 70s, of wanting to be an audio engineer. So we're going to hear what Joyce has to say about that. This Week in Radio Tech, brought to you in part by Broadcast Tools. That's Don Wingett's organization, and sold by Broadcasters General Store. Broadcast Tools has got something that I'm finding is very helpful at a lot of radio transmitter sites, and that is a BNC switcher router. You know, so many FM stations, there's nothing wrong with still using analog BNC connections between your FM processor, or maybe the output of an STL system, or maybe the output of a micro MPX decoder into your FM exciter. And plenty of stations, you know, using this technology, and it can be done very, very well. Well, you might need to switch those things, and you might need to switch them remotely. Well, that's where Broadcast Tools comes in with the SS2.1 MLR-BNC. Okay, that's a lot of letters. The MLR-BNC switcher router. It's a transparent two-input dual-output switcher router with mechanical latching relays and BNC connectors. Now, if you think that sounds old-fashioned with mechanical latching relays, hey, you want reliability here, and you want when the power goes out and comes back on, it comes back on exactly the way it was. It's perfect for composite, MPX, or other types of passive signal switching via front panel switches, contact closures, or even serial RS-232. Now, that switching is accomplished with mechanical latching gold contact relays, and that means the unit can route a signal in either direction. Due to the passive nature of the switching, any input level and any impedance can be used. Inputs may be balanced or unbalanced, and while output levels, impedance, distortion, noise, and balancing will match that of the selected input exactly. No changes, nothing goes wrong in the unit in terms of your signal at all. It can be controlled and monitored locally and or with simple contact closures to ground, as well as multi-drop RS-232 serial commands. So this is pretty cool. I mean, if you got to switch things and you want your transmitter site to be reliable, be right, and be able to switch that backup chain on the air, this is your huckleberry right here. The audio mute function allows you to turn off all the audio if you need to. Oh my gosh, get that off the air. You can do it. This is your final say-so before you turn the transmitter off. And the front panel enable switch can be configured to provide a safety lock to the front panel selection push button switches. Don Wingett really thinks these things through and builds equipment that is purpose-built to do a job that we broadcasters need to get done. By the way, the PowerUp source selection feature allows the user to select which source is active at PowerUp, whether it's the last source or whether it's, you know, a definite source. So it's fully RFI proof, surge protected, internal power supply, power adapter with domestic connector supplied. International power supply options are there too. And up to 3 units can be mounted in a optional RA1 rack shelf. Check this thing out. It is the BNC switcher router from Broadcast Tools. And if you need to get this or any of the Broadcast Tools equipment, and man, there's a lot of things on in their catalog, go to Broadcaster's General Store. The website, bgs.cc. Yes, they're going to be at the NAB show. Stop by and see them. Man, they bring half the inventory to the show, including consoles and things from my employer, Telos Alliance, from Axie, and also from Angry Audio, that Rave console. Check them out, bgs.cc, or call them at 352-622-7700. The number's right there on the website, and they love to talk to you on the phone. Thanks a lot, Broadcaster General Store, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. We've got a few minutes remaining with Joyce Lieberman, the radio and engineering supervisor at WHYY. And I want to get Chris's comments too, but Joyce, you were telling me a story about how you got started and got noticed, and apparently just raising your hand once wasn't enough. How'd you get noticed?
Well, I was telling you a story about a time in the early 80s when WHYY Radio was doing a news show. It was a half-hour news show, local news. We had like 5 or 6 reporters doing a great job reporting on wonderful things in Philadelphia. And I started asking if I could do the show. Mostly the people who were doing it were 2 guys that were also radio engineers with me and very generous, lovely people. And the show was done on a console. We first set up in one of our smaller TV studios. It was a mom's console. We started out with clusing together lots of equipment that we had. So early on, I started saying, I would like to do the show also. So I was told many times, well, we're not quite ready for you to do the show. They said, oh, you know, Jay and Paul, they're very experienced engineers, and I'm sure that they could handle it, and I'm not sure you're ready yet. So another couple of weeks would go along, and then I'd say, I'd like to do the show. And the supervisor said, no, not quite yet. You need to do these other shifts. There's early shifts, there's late shifts. Luckily, I wasn't put on night shifts. There was someone who liked doing the night shift. Then one week, both of those engineers were sick. So they said, Joyce, we need you to do the show. So I said, okay. So I went in, I did the show. That day I had a terrible stomach ache, but the show went fine. And then for the next week I did the show, and the following week I did the show also. So after a week and a half, the anxiety level for me was less, and there I was, being able to do the show and being rotated into the shift as everybody else was. So.
Yes, just you kept asking. Yeah, I love how that worked out. I'm so glad it did for you. Chris Tarr, what we heard Joyce's break, pounding on the door and until the break comes along. What was your break, Chris, into kind of the engineering you wanted to do?
Actually, it was pretty similar. First of all, you know, I always joke that I didn't know better than the fact that I should have said no. I was too stupid to go, I probably shouldn't do that. I had one just general mentor in my life, and a radio guy. And very, very early in my career, he said to me, because I was on the on-air side first, and he said, Chris, you know, I could hire a bunch of great voices, you know, for $10. I mean, everybody out there with a good voice can do this job. He said there are very few people, that can do everything. So he said, if you want to get places, raise your hand and do everything that you can do. And he was right. I mean, I went from on the air to writing copy to, you know, helping out in engineering, and, you know, I eventually found my place, but it was just that I just wanted to help no matter what it was. And it was interesting because my story was kind of the same thing about my first break on the air. Same thing. You know, we're going to have you doing nights or weekends or whatever. And then one day, you know, somebody was sick and couldn't show up, and they knew that I would say I'd be available, that I would just, they have to worry, they knew I was going to show up if they called me, and they did. And that was kind of my first break. So, with my mentees with SBE, that's one of the things I tell them, never be afraid to say no. And certainly never be afraid to raise your hand, no matter what it is. Even if it's not really your job or in your wheelhouse, just to get the experience to do it. Really, I think I'm a better engineer because I have done all of these things, and therefore I really can see things from their points of view. So, you know, earlier when I was talking about, you know, making technology become invisible and get out of their way, well, I was on the air. I know what that's like, you know, so I kind of am able to do what I do in the same way, you know, because I've been in that chair. I go, well, you know what, if it were me sitting there, here's what I'd want. So yeah, very similar upbringing where, you know, I just, there are times where I probably for my own good should have said no, but I didn't.
Isn't it amazing the number of careers that get jump-started because somebody's sick?
Yeah,
that happened. and
you've got to be ready to take that opportunity. You know, if either of us said no, I mean, who knows where we'd be now? I mean, you know, if I just said, you know, I'm busy, you know, who knows what happened?
That's right.
Yeah, it's great to take that opportunity and try something different. Yeah. Oh, and I just want to go back to talking about Skip Peasy. You mentioned Skip at the beginning, or maybe before the beginning, and I went to a workshop that NPR had many, many years ago in 1986. It was a music recording workshop, and Skip Peasy was instrumental in just showing me that you just participate, you just try things, you know, you try recording, you try different mic techniques, you record different people in different ways, and just try it. And then Skip was instrumental in helping us at Fresh Air to set up our studio and control room, just knowing what equipment to buy and how to set up the studio. And he had us come down to NPR and see how NPR set up things for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And that was just amazing to have that.
So speaking of Skip, Joyce, I'll confess, I contacted Skip and I said, Skip, I got Joyce on the show with me, and I'm not sure exactly what to ask her. Maybe you can suggest something. And Skip said, ask her about theater sound. She does things outside of radio that have to do with sound. And so maybe you can tell me something about theater sound. What's different? What's interesting about that to you?
Well, years ago I worked with a group called the Good Sound Foundation, and we were providing lots of different speaker monitors in a theater so that a really complex soundscape could be made. We were using an analog console without automation, and it was very difficult to make it happen. But just setting up a large array of speakers made the sound really rich, and you could really localize, you know, a dog barking way off in someone's backyard or someone creeping up close to you, and you could hear the sound really close to your head. So that was really a wonderful experience to be doing that. And I was lucky enough to record a couple of radio theater pieces. And that, of course, is done not in a theater, but it's done in a studio. And you record really good sounds of miking people, you know, very high quality mics. And then later you add lots of the sounds, the Foley sounds, just sounds that you need to add to enhance what the actors are doing. And I had gone to a couple of theater workshops that happened across the country. So Skip might be referring to that.
Well, cool. We are talking to Joyce Lieberman. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tarr, and our show is coming to a close pretty soon. We're going to ask Joyce to supply us with maybe a tip of the week coming up in just a minute. You know, what words of wisdom would Joyce like to leave me and Chris and you, our viewers and listeners, with? That's coming up in just a minute. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by Broadcast Bionics. They're in the UK, but they're right at your back door, and they can ship you an amazing box if you'd like. Let's check it out. It's called Virtual Rack. Virtual Rack is, well, it's this idea where more and more broadcast infrastructure is available as Docker containers, software containers. And these are used extensively outside of broadcast in transactional development in data centers. If you send me $10 with PayPal, it's going to go through some Docker containers. Well, my employer, Telos Alliance, as well as Sound4 and 2WCOM, have some Docker containers available to do your bidding in the broadcast world. You can get audio consoles, broadcast phone systems, audio processing, even intercom systems for broadcast to run in Docker containers. Well, Broadcast Bionics has made this super easy with the virtual rack. We've had Dan McQuillan, Broadcast Bionics founder, on the show before to explain this. If you're really interested, you can go back a little bit less than a year and listen to that show, watch that show. But it's a purpose-built appliance. That is, it's a standard off-the-shelf server, but the software in it is purpose-built. You turn the thing on, you browse into it, and you have, well, kind of like an app store. You can choose the broadcast functions that you want to occur in that box. You click them, they go to the internet, they go to the respective manufacturers of those functions, and they download them and install them. And what Bionics has done, Broadcast Bionics, what they've done is they've made this so easy, because I got to tell you, if you are yourself are installing Docker containers and creating Mac VLANs in an Ubuntu environment, it ain't easy. There's a lot you can mess up with that. That's one reason why, for example, my employer, Telos Alliance, one of our options is to pay us to do it for you if you're using your own hardware. There's also a number of broadcast equipment dealers around the world that will install these things for you and deliver it already installed. Bionics takes a different approach. You get to install it, but they do the hard work under the hood for you. That's why it's called Virtual Rack. They also won't let you over-install. You can't install more in there than what it will do. Hey, on the screen right now, we see deploy, failover, and applications. Failover is pretty interesting. You can buy two of these and have them monitor each other and do a failover if that's necessary. Now, myself, I got to tell you, I'm using containerized broadcast products myself at my new radio stations that I built last year in Oxford, Mississippi. It's a rock station with some HD channels. We've got an oldies and a light urban channel, and we're using containerized broadcast products for several things. Well, I could have done it with Broadcast Bionics just by getting this server, the virtual rack, and clicking a few things. In fact, if you go to NAB, or if you just watch one of these videos that's on the webpage, you can see Dan install these functions, broadcast functions, maybe the best way to say it, virtualized broadcast equipment, and set them up. And now you still have to license whatever you pick through its respective manufacturer. When you buy the server, you're not buying the license to use the software. You're able to install it and install it properly and set the IP addresses and all that. And then you contact each manufacturer, get the licensing for it, and off you go with reliable broadcast functionality. Check it out from Broadcast Bionics, the website bionics.co.uk. There's a link to it in the show notes, or bionic.radio. And you can also contact your local dealer. Wherever you are in the world, there are dealers all over the world for Broadcast Bionics, and ask them about Virtual Rack. Cool as can be. Thanks a lot, Dan McQuillan and Broadcast Bionics, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech and for making cool technology for us broadcasters. All right, our final minutes here with Joyce Lieberman with WHYY. Joyce, can you drum up some words of wisdom to leave us with today?
Yes. What I think of is working with your engineering compatriots, working with your with your other engineers as a team. You know, it's great to be able to, for me to be able to maybe help on a TV project or help another, help when another engineer has a project going. And again, for people to help me with other, with projects that I have. So working, doing the work as a team is real, is very essential. It makes for good discussion in the shop about how to solve things. It makes for, you know, more far-ranging ways to do things. One thing I think of just recently, we were, there was a large server at WHOY that had a problem. It went down. And there were lots of services and different applications on the server. And unfortunately, our Telos VX telephone system went down with it. And mostly not because of the Telos VX, but it was because it needs an interface with the SIP provider, with the specialized, you know, telephones that are coming into the station, and it uses an asterisk server. That asterisk server was not there for a couple of days because it was on this other bigger server that went down. So then when it came back up, the Telos VX system still wasn't working. We thought we had a username and password. It wasn't working for 2 days. Then luckily it began working, and there was still a lot to set up. So there was one evening I was there, past my time. I usually work till about 6, so maybe I was there till 7:30. I tried to get it working. It didn't work, so I left instructions. Instead of working through it, I left the instructions. Halfway through the instructions, I thought, oh, I think I could have done it. And then there wasn't really time to finish the instructions and then try to do it, so I left the instructions. And another engineer, this wonderful engineer, John, picked up on the instructions I gave him. He was able to fix it. So what that gave us all at WHYY was that me and John know much more about the system, and we're going to go further and document what we did. But it was an incredible learning experience to do it that way as a team.
Once again, somebody got sick. This time it was a server.
Right.
It gave you a learning opportunity. Whether you wanted it or not, it gave you a learning opportunity. We have got to go. I'm so sorry we're out of time. Chris, you want to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Okay. I'm sorry. It's about all the time we have for. Joyce, it's been a delight to have you with us. Thank you so very much for taking the time out of your day to be here with us. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to both of you. Thank you.
All right. Chris Tarr, Kirk Harnack, This Week in Radio Tech, and Joyce Lieberman, the radio engineering supervisor, WHYY, has been our guest. Suncast is our producer. Thanks very much, Suncast, for doing a great job on the show, as usual. And we have got to run. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.